things get a little bit grim. But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah! That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I just realized I did not get a water before we sat down.
Oh, bummer.
Oh, well. It's good.
I guess you'll just be parched.
I'll starve to death.
I guess I'll starve.
I guess I'll just gotta dehydrate and turn into a raisin.
Raisin? That's that's how I feel every morning I wake up after I've had a glass of dry red wine.
Oh, literally, like, just a slug that has had salt poured on it.
Yes.
A withering being of my former self.
Crusty from the inside out. Oh, hold on. I already know.
Oh.
Let me take off the jangles.
Gosh dang it, jangles.
I know. I just wear it so people know I'm coming.
Oh, okay. Yeah, like so, a warning.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
It's an omen. You know how like church bells ring and it sends like terror down your spine?
Sure. I was more thinking like the purge sound. Like,
it's a siren telling you to take cover.
Yeah.
Well, hi today. Listen, in reality.
In real time.
It's Halloween. It's Halloween.
So happy Halloween.
Happy belated
Halloween. Wait.
Oh, wait. We don't know when this comes out.
Scratch all of that.
Never mind. Listen, I don't know why you thought you were going to get like professional podcasters.
No, that's not what this is.
That's not what this is even a little.
Oh my gosh. Yesterday I had dinner with one of our friends that is good in like the audio world. And we were talking about the podcast and he was like, it sounds so good. And I was like, thank you. We just don't have like a whole lot of equipment. And he was like, what kind of equipment do you have? And I was like, mics.
And a laptop.
And he's like, what about your audio interface? And I was like, don't have that.
No. We tried that.
Yeah.
He was like, the doodad box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was like, what about headphones? And I was like, no.
No.
And he was like, what?
Did we just accidentally nail it?
I think so. I don't know. But it just made me laugh so hard that he was completely mind boggled.
I mean, sometimes we do have some like audio.
Yeah.
I was just listening to an episode. I think you should bring your mic closer to your face.
Mine?
Yeah. Because you were a little. Just put it right up against your lips. It's giving very Christina. It's giving very Christina Aguilera in the studio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love. I could never.
No, me either. No one could ever compare. She's a classic.
She is. Gotta love her.
Man.
I love
some
old Christina. I love some new Christina.
The dirty.
Oh.
The dirty. Where she had those like assless chaps that she wore with a thong.
Yeah.
Iconic.
How are we allowed to listen to that in middle school?
You know, I really don't know. I don't know. I was younger than that when I'm a genie
in
a bottle.
You gotta touch me the right way.
Why did we get away with that?
How?
You know what other song? Now that Anchor lets us put like Spotify songs in our episodes.
Uh-huh.
What would you do if someone's at home crying all alone on the bed? Because you're hungry. How? They just played that on the radio.
Well, I mean, this is the era of WAP too, though.
That's true. Theo likes Body by Megan Thee Stallion.
Of course he does. He also likes Watermelon Sugar.
He does like Watermelon Sugar. He really thinks it's about watermelon, though. Sweet honey. He's a sweet baby child.
One of my friends just figured out that it is not, in fact, about watermelon.
No, it's about, isn't it about banging in the summer?
No.
What's it about?
Going down on a girl.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Watermelon. Sugar?
You have to watch the music video.
No.
Have you ever seen the music video?
No.
It is indecent.
Tastes like strawberries on a summer evening?
Uh-huh.
That is dirty.
The music video alone makes me blush.
Okay. I will add that to my to-do list this evening.
Followed by you.
Oh, gosh. Well, hold on. I had a thought and it escaped.
The brain soup.
My clutches.
No.
Too close.
Too close to what?
The song.
Too close.
Why you always lie? Now you're dancing real close. What?
Sorry.
Feel a little poke coming through?
You haven't heard? I don't think so.
What? How do you not know?
I'm uneducated.
It's been a meme for years. Oh, Taylor.
Jenny, you and I find ourselves on very different sides of the internet.
Yeah, we do. We do.
Like, you and William will be going back and forth about something, and I'm just looking at both of you like, what the hell is happening?
What are you talking about?
What is happening?
Well, what side of the internet are you on?
I don't know. Mostly, like, research and really trashy romance novels.
Okay. All right.
And TikTok. I don't know.
Okay. We're in very different parts of the internet.
Yeah. Do you remember StumbleUpon?
Oh, do you remember fucking Neopets?
Yeah.
Ooh, I lost a lot of my youth on Neopets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sure did.
Yeah. Really thought I was something. I remember trying. Remember ASL?
Oh yeah.
Dude, I lied. I always lied.
Always. Yeah. Every time. It's a miracle I was not sex trafficked.
Oh my God.
As a young girl.
I love that the threat for us was like, oh, they're going to get into chat rooms and like be groomed by men. Like, no, I was catfishing men across the country at the age of 2 years old.
2 years?
No, 12.
12.
Sorry, not two.
Yeah.
12.
Yeah. No, same. I was like 13 and I was like, 17.
Right. 20. Green eyes. California.
Uh-huh. Athletic body.
Always.
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 Just a complete lie.
Just catfishing.
Left, right, and center.
Before it was even a thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank goodness they never said, like, send me, like, your name. Like, send me a picture with you holding your name or, like,
oh,
a validation of some kind.
And this was, like, AOL online.
Yeah.
AIM.
Uh-huh.
With the, like, away messages and.
Oh, my gosh. What a time to be alive.
Oh, my God. You know what? It's funny that we're talking about this because I have had a craving, something has come over me, uh-huh, and I think it's because we are now in Scorpio season.
Yeah.
And I have a hunger, a soul desire. I can only listen to Hawthorne Heights right now.
I understand that.
Thank you.
I've been in a big Paramore kick.
Ooh, that's a good one to, mm-hmm, always go back and revisit.
Yep.
I'm probably going to listen to nothing but Hawthorne Heights and probably the same like six songs for about 2 weeks.
And then we need to switch to the Spill Canvas.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because you got to get to know these new songs, my dude.
I know. Listen, I have made it through many a Spill Canvas concert.
Without knowing all the songs.
Without knowing all the songs. Listen, I only go, the only reason I continue to go to Spill Canvas concerts with you and Allie is because I always meet Nick. And you guys
don't. It's true.
It's, what is this, three times?
Probably, yeah.
Three times?
Mm-hmm. Still, to this day, one of my favorite pictures is when finally I got to meet Nick because you had stumbled upon him outside and I left Allie high and dry in the middle of the restaurant.
Oh, well, listen, you guys left me high and dry.
I know. I'll never live it down. but I got to talk to him. We got a couple pictures with him and there's one picture where I'm smiling and he's looking at me. And when he's looking at me, he's telling me that I'm adorable. And I will die on that hill of happiness.
Framed.
Absolutely.
It's a beautiful photo.
100%.
I think I put it on your picture frame. Ah, there it is. There she is.
Yeah. So. I mean, it's sure to be a disaster.
And we're back. Welcome to A Little Bit Grim. It's the podcast you're listening to. That's Taylor.
That's Jenny over there. Welcome. Hi. We're so glad you found us.
Hi. We're here to talk about
disasters today.
Mine is fucking disgusting.
But mine is not that disgusting. It's really fascinating, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
I mean, it's a little it's a little bit grim. But who goes first? Do you want to rock, paper, scissors for it?
Yep.
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
With the scissor.
I'm going first. Okay, so this is one that's been on my list for a while.
Okay.
To do. And I was desperately trying to think about what I was going to be doing a couple of days ago when this just popped right back into my head. So I am so excited to tell you about the Man-Eaters of Tsavo.
The what?
Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Okay. All right.
It sounds made up. This sounds like a folklore.
It is, in fact, not a folklore.
The Man Eaters of Savo.
Uh-huh.
She's a man eater, make her work hard, make her spit hard.
This is a musical podcast today.
No shit.
Okay. So our story today is going to revolve around a man named Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson, who was an Irish member of the British Army.
Okay.
He was fairly young when he rose through the ranks of the British Army, and he was driven to succeed and had an undeniable sense of adventure.
Mm.
He was also an engineer and was sent to Kenya to oversee the construction of the Kenya-Uganda Railway and a railway bridge that went over the Savo River, which is kind of like on the western side of Kenya.
Okay.
He arrived in Kenya in March of 1898. The Savo River was a desolate area. It was just, people described it as scorched.
Ooh.
Like, where I was in Kenya, things were still really, like, grassy and more of, like, the grasslands area.
What kind of season did you go in?
I went in, gosh, April? I think I went in March or April.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just... It was before, just before, just after the rainy season, because we wanted to see like all the herds of buffalo come through.
Yeah,
but we missed that by like 2 weeks.
Oh, bummer.
But it was really, really nice when we were there.
Okay.
Like really nice temperature. It rained a little bit, but not too much. It was very much like
did
spring
you bless
in Indiana.
The rains
in Africa?
Down in Africa?
Yes, we did.
Good.
Yeah, we sang that at the top of our lungs when it started raining while we were on the safari one day. Absolutely.
Love that.
Yeah. So the trees were all dead. Just think of as much of desert as you can.
Okay.
Without it being sand. The ground was red clay.
Yep.
Patterson described the trees like being spikes poking up from the ground. They had to avoid thorn bushes and a menagerie of different dangerous animals.
Ooh.
The area had already known its fair share of bloodshed as well. A few really horrible tribal battles had taken place there over the years, and it was the route of the Arab slave trade.
Ooh, gross.
Yeah. So, because it was so desolate and not a friendly place to be, people died there a lot.
Okay, believe that.
Enslaved people were often bitten by the African tsetse fly, which transmitted diseases.
Ooh.
Yeah, and so when they would inevitably die from these diseases, they were just left along the route.
Oh my god, that's gross.
Yeah, so they were then eaten by whatever predator got there first. In most cases, lions.
That's metal.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in 1898, the camp for the people working on the railroad spanned about 8 mile stretch. So this was a huge camp.
Okay.
And it accommodated several thousand workers. The workers had almost all been brought to East Africa from India or Pakistan, and it was only 2 days after Patterson arrived that things went sideways. The name Savo actually means place of slaughter in the local language.
Ugh.
Yeah. So, two male lions had gotten the taste of human flesh and had stumbled upon this gigantic campsite of nothing but walking fucking drumsticks. So... these two lions basically were eating all of the people from the slave trade.
Uh-huh.
And realized how easy humans were to kill. And to eat.
Oh, great. We created
An
apex predator.
Yes.
Gave them a taste for flesh.
Yep. Surprisingly, the noise created by the construction did little to deter the lions. In fact, it almost seems that the ruckus drew the lions in. At night, when the construction had stopped and the men were sound asleep in their tents, the silence would be punctuated with screams. On the second or third morning after Patterson had arrived, they realized that one of their men, a porter, had gone missing. The people told Patterson that it was most likely lions, but Patterson had a hard time believing that since he was taken from his own tent. He wasn't just like wandering around in the African bush somewhere.
Right.
He was
sleeping
inside his tent surrounded by other people. They immediately started searching for him and soon found a set of tracks with drag marks that looked like somebody had dug their fingernails into the ground to keep from being dragged. They followed this trail for several miles and then finally made a gruesome discovery, his mutilated body.
Ooh.
Immediately, they were like, oh, fuck, it's lions.
just snatching people out of the tent?
Yep.
Oh my god, that's a bold lion.
Yeah, so this is a little gruesome, but the lions had licked at his cheeks so much that he looked like he was smiling. So when they originally came up upon his body, they thought that he was still alive.
I can't imagine how rough a lion's tongue is.
Oh my gosh, it's like spiky.
Yeah. Is it?
Yeah.
Like his little barbs?
Yeah.
Hold on.
Google it.
Lion's tongue. Jesus. Yeah, it is spiky.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It's like the worst kind of Velcro. Okay, keep going.
Danger Velcro.
Danger Velcro.
The next day, Patterson left the camp to search for the lion that could have been responsible for the man's death, but instead found even more bodies. All of the men who had gone missing during previous expeditions. Within hours, another one of Patterson's men disappeared. Then he was found mauled and dismembered. It went on like this for weeks.
Oh.
By April. He got there in March. In April, 17 people had been taken from their tents.
Oh my god.
Yeah. These lions were just like snacks.
Free snacks. It's like
sleeping
a
snacks.
This is horrifying. How do you sleep?
Oh my gosh.
Well, you don't have somebody staying up, keeping watch? Like, you know,
the lions are not afraid.
Well, get a gun.
Of people. They have guns. I don't know. Listen, I don't know.
Okay. All right.
But, okay. So,
I won't poke too many holes in this.
While the lion is an apex predator, it is really unusual behavior for them. They normally lie in wait for their prey, but these lions actively... these lions actively sought out humans to attack.
Ugh.
They knew that they would be sleeping in canvas tents, which were relatively easy to tear apart. The lions would grab a person by the ankle or wrist and then drag them out into the bush and finish them off.
Oh, God.
To try to ward the lions off, the workers would build huge fires every night, but it did not instill fear in the lions at all. They just did not care. They did not fear humans in any way, shape, or form.
Jesus.
Eventually, the construction on the railroad ceased. People were terrified, and they realized that the lions were attacking people in the tents on the ground. Or when they realized that they were attacking people in tents, they started putting shelters in the trees.
Okay.
But there were too many men and not enough high shelters, so the weight of all the men sleeping in the trees would make the tree fall down.
Oh.
So eventually they had no more high options.
Okay. So we're just back on the ground.
Yeah. The fear the people of the camps felt would have been completely unimaginable. The lions were incredibly fucking smart. The workers had to keep moving the camp hospital around because the lions kept figuring out which area the hospital was in.
They can probably smell it.
Mm-hmm. And they would stalk it at night, knowing that the weakest of the people would be there.
Jesus. It's like it's giving very clever girl.
Yes.
From Jurassic Park.
Yes. Absolutely. Raptors. They did attack the camp hospital and were able to kill a patient. Even after the hospital was moved, one lion penetrated the thick thorn fence that they built, which was called a boma, to protect it, and dragged the water carrier away to his death.
Ooh-hoo.
They realized, finally, that it was a duo of lions, both male and both with no manes.
Weird.
Yeah. The people nicknamed these lions the Ghost and the Darkness.
Yeah. Oh.
Months went by with terror gripping the people in the camp. The government was insistent on the railway being finished, so they had to get the job done. While the construction was ongoing, Patterson hunted the lions. In the course of hunting these lions, Patterson encountered a red-spitting cobra, a rhinoceros, a hippopotamus, a pack of wild dogs, a wildebeest that faked dying, a herd of zebra, of which he captured 6.
Wow.
And all of this is outlined in his book he would later write about his experiences. In his attempt to end the reign of terror, Patterson set multiple traps for the lions and attempted to ambush them from the trees on multiple occasions. He was foiled every time by their cunning.
Outsmarted by the Ghost in the Darkness?
Yes. The lions are not the only challenge to completing the bridge project, however. Tensions between the native workers and the Sikhs brought in from the British East India to work on the project threatened to stop the project altogether. At one point, Patterson meets a danger far greater than the lions, a fierce flood. It wipes out the supply bridges and wraps iron girders around the tree trunks like wire. Uprooted tree trunks act like battering rams trying to annihilate the bridge. But the well-built bridge stayed intact, and this challenge proved that the year spent working on the bridge had not been wasted.
Okay.
But, I mean, we're just having a bad time.
It sounds like literally the worst time you could have.
Yeah.
Like, what a nightmare project.
A bad time.
Oh, God.
In December of 1898, Patterson saw an opportunity to kill the lions. He got workmen together and gathered tins and other noisy instruments. He had them get into a semicircle and walk into the African bush. He knew that the lions would not pass up an opportunity to take them in, and Patterson hid behind a small hill and waited. Finally, the lion came within 15 yards of his position, but his double-barreled rifle misfired. The noise brought the lion's attention to Patterson, who was able to shoot again, but the lion was charging at him.
No!
He was able to injure it, and it ran back into the bush.
Oh, thank God.
He didn't kill it.
Okay. Now it's mad.
Now it's fucking mad. But Patterson was absolutely determined to end the terror. That evening, he built a tree stand with a chair perched above the ground and sat a dead donkey carcass as bait below him.
Ew.
I know. The lion seemingly knew that Patterson wanted him dead, and the lion came upon the tree stand and started stalking Patterson. Changing the game completely. However, Patterson was able to actually kill the first man-eating lion with two bullets.
Good for him.
Right.
Wonder how big of bullets they were. Like, what kind of slugs he had.
Oh, I did not find that information.
Like a .45 shotgun?
Maybe. A few days later, Patterson set up the same trap. The shot was fired, and again, he injured the lion, but did not immediately kill him. They kept looking for the lion, thinking that he would succumb to his wound, but they could not locate him. Finally, 11 days later, Patterson set up the bait trap again, and the lion emerged from the bushes, and Patterson shot him. The horrors of the man-eating lions of Tsavo came to an end. After word got out, Patterson became a national hero.
Good for him.
The lions themselves were unique creatures, first because they did not have manes like we would normally associate with a male lion. Scientists believe that this is due to the extreme heat in this area of Africa, and average male lions are normally between 9 to 10 feet long.
Ooh.
So man-eater number one, aka the ghost, ended up being 9 feet 8 inches long and 3 feet 9 inches high.
Okay.
Man-eater 2, the darkness, is 9 feet 6 inches long and 3 feet 11 inches high. So these were big.
That's a big ass. I don't know why I was thinking they were like the size of a mastiff. I know they're not.
Long.
They're big old boys.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Like, I'm thinking, like, I'm laying on the ground. I'm 5'6".
Whoa. Wait a minute now. It's like, if you laid us top to tail.
Yeah.
And, like, cut off my head.
That's how long these lions are.
That's how long these lions are.
Yeah.
We'll take a picture.
Yes. Find us on the Instagram. Okay. So after they were killed, each of them required no less than 8 men to carry them back to camp. Now, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, big game hunting did not have the stigma associated as it does today. And back then, hunters weren't regarded as people causing damage to ecosystems, but rather experts in their field.
Okay.
So people looked to them for information on what was happening in, like, the African bush and stuff because they were always out there.
Right. Well, and, like, in situations like this, I bet you're glad you have a big game hunter.
Right. Patterson took both lions home and had them skinned and used their pelts as rugs.
I would have eaten them.
What? You're gonna eat the lion that eat humans?
Yeah. Assert my dominance. I'm not gonna eat its stomach where the people are. I'm gonna, like, eat its leg or something, like a roast lion leg. No?
I don't think that's how it works. I don't know. So they were able to do testing on their fur, and their fur was able to tell them how many humans they ate.
Wow.
So I feel like meat would also be able to tell you how many humans they ate.
I mean, okay.
You know what I mean?
All right. You're saying it's like cannibalism by proxy?
Yeah. Cannibal curious.
We keep cycling back to this.
Yes, we do. Okay. So Eventually, he would sell the pelts to the Field Museum in Chicago, where they are taxidermied and put on display, and you can see them today.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah. Patterson wrote a book on his experience, which is where we get almost all of the accounts of what happened during those 9 months in the Tsavo region. The book is called The Man-Eaters of Tsavo, which was published in 1907. In the book, Patterson details his experiences and alleges that the lions ate approximately 135 people during his time in the African bush. Scientists have long been trying to understand why these lions took to hunting people, and there are a couple of theories. According to Bruce Patterson, who is in no relation to John Henry Patterson, but also is like an expert in the Tsavo lion, so we see his name a lot. In his 2004 book, The Lions of Tsavo, Exploring the Legacy of Africa's Notorious Man-Eaters, these lions started hunting men for one or more of these four reasons. In 1898, an outbreak of cattle plague left the lions with little food. They had to find some other food source, so they turned to humans.
Mm.
The lions may have developed an appetite for humans from eating the dead men found along the Tsavo River. The Hindus working on the railway had cremations for their dead, which may have initiated scavenging by the lions. And then severe dental disease may meant that the lions migrated to humans as prey, as they are easier to catch and chew.
Oh, yeah. Probably not as big of bones as a buffalo.
Right. So now that the technology has caught up with us a bit, scientists know more about the Tsavo lions than ever before. They took samples of their hair and were able to see what their diet consisted of. One lion seemed to have more of an appetite for humans than the other. The first lion had about 11% of its diet made up of humans, while the other only had about 8%. But then this kind of disproves the fact that there was nothing else to eat.
Right. If that was only 11% of their diet.
They just liked it.
They just thought they were tasty.
Yeah. Scientists think that even though Patterson said up to 135 people were killed by the lions, really there could have only been about 35. But in some of Patterson's writing, we can assume that the lion didn't eat all of the humans as prey.
Oh.
So sometimes they just killed people and would kill just to kill and leave the body behind.
And not eat?
And not eat it.
Oh, that is so malicious. If you're going to kill me, at least eat me.
Right. Please let me do good for you.
Right.
So we are still studying the man-eaters of Tsavo today to learn more about what caused these lions to go rogue and hunt humans. And unfortunately, this region is still known for the lions with a taste for humans.
Sorry. What? I didn't mean to interrupt
you.
No, going.
You're
fine. I feel like you're about to tell me.
Today, lions are responsible for about 200 deaths a year in Africa.
Wow.
Yeah. And that is the Tsavo lions.
That is terrifying.
Yeah.
Gross. You do such a good job with, like, the animal.
That's my favorite.
I know. You do such a good job.
Thanks.
That was amazing.
Yeah. Good one. It was kind of short, but it was... I
like it.
I like it. Tell me about this heinous story you're about to tell me.
It's so gross. Listen, I'm just telling this purely for the shock factor. It's disgusting. Are you ready?
Yes.
So I'm going to tell you about the Cincinnati privy disaster of 1904.
I'm sorry, what?
The Cincinnati privy disaster of 1904.
Okay, all right. I love that we're in the same, like,
time frame
here.
Yeah, like turn of the century.
Yeah.
Do you know what a privy is?
Is it something to do with water?
A bathroom.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, yes. Although the morning paper said that it would be a fair warming day, the horizon darkened with looming rain. Principal Thomas L. Zimmerman watched the fidgeting children line up in the hall and decided to give them a few minutes of frolic and exercise. A little rain would not hurt them. It was a Friday, and they were always restless on Friday, so at precisely 10:15 a.m., September 23rd, 1904, Zimmerman rang the bell, one ominous clang, to release the students of the Pleasant Ridge School for morning recess and watch them file outside. The school's enrollment was up by nearly half this year, some 297 children altogether. Among 50 of those came from the nearby village of Rosmoyne, whose school had been condemned by the state.
Well,
in defiance of an unpopular board of education, the village had 3 times failed to pass a bond issue to construct a new one, so its students had been reassigned to Pleasant Ridge. Caring little about the threatening skies, the boys immediately started a game of baseball. The girls scattered about the playground in smaller groups. Zimmerman had misjudged the proximity of the approaching storm, and only a few minutes passed before the wind kicked up and the first scattered raindrops started to fall. The ball game continued for another minute, and the girls huddled together but didn't seek shelter until a sudden downpour caught them off guard.
Mm-hmm.
The boys playing ball and most of the girls ran for the school building, but some of the girls, at least 30, made a dash for the outhouse on their side of the playground.
Uh-oh.
The outhouse was a whitewashed 10-foot square frame building. It was positioned over a 12-foot deep stone vault and located on the east side of the Pleasant Ridge School. The building was 11 years old and had been repaired several times. Just a year prior, the school hired a carpenter to install new seats and replace the flooring and siding. The carpenter presumed the building was sound when he laid the new floor over the old one, which he did without inspecting the joists.
Uh-oh.
Elsie Shore, 14, was among the first girls to enter the privy. When she saw how many girls were trying to squeeze into the small, smelly place, she had a vision of a collapsing floor and tried to get out, but the bottleneck of the other side of the door pushed her back inside. 12-year-old Hazel Sinor heard someone say, "Oh, what if this would break down with us here?"
Oh, God.
The words had hardly came out of her mouth when something happened, Hazel said.
Oh, no.
Without the slightest groaning of the wood or tremble of the floor, the joists on one side of the building, sodden from years of moisture, gave way. In an instant, the entire floor crashed to the bottom of the vault, carrying with it a crowd of shocked and frightened girls. There were at least 31, maybe as many as 35.
Jesus.
Inside the tiny, in like a 10-foot space.
That is
too many people per square foot.
No. Yeah. We got occupancy standard issues happening.
Inside the tiny room, the floor fell out from underneath of them. The collapse began on the south side of the building. The floor fell nearly 8 feet straight down and disintegrated.
Oh, worst nightmare. That's like elevator shit.
Yep.
Ooh, I don't like elevators.
Churning with the children in a stone vault with a pool of foul water and waste 4 feet deep.
Holy shit.
The children were as young as 7.
Oh, gosh, babies. And they were all girls?
All girls.
Oh, sweet things.
Some of the girls were dancing and jumping about when the floor gave way, said Elsie Ferguson, 16, also one of the first in the building. When I arrived there, said Edna Girk, 14, I could hardly get inside the door. I managed to squeeze in, and then before any of us knew the danger or could get out, the floor gave way. She said there was no crash at all. There was no noise whatsoever. The floor just fell. That's all there was to it. Not a child screamed that I heard. I felt the floor going and jumped quickly, clutching to the side of the door. I was left hanging to it, and with all my strength, I pulled myself up and out of that place. 5 other girls escaped the same way. Some of the girls had climbed up on the toilet seats to make room for the others and managed to hop from one to the other back out to the doorway. I remember sinking down and smothering, said Hazel.
Oh, gosh.
When I found I could breathe again, I just felt like I had awakened from a dream. I caught hold of the stones on the side and held myself up so I could breathe. I felt the soft, struggling bodies of lots of girls around me and underneath me somewhere.
Oh.
They touched me. I could see heads sometimes and then feet. Everything became dark, said Edna Girk. Everybody was clutching at her neighbor while there was a terrible outcry. I think every girl was crying at the top of her voice. We were all tangled up with each other and struggled to get free.
Oh my God.
I was pushed about and some attempted to climb up on my shoulders. I made a grab for a stone I could see projecting above my head and for a moment held on, but there were so many tugging at me that the weight tore my hand loose and I went down. Even then, the struggle continued under the water. With desperation, I freed myself and looking up saw daylight, which I'd never expected to behold again. In the panic that ensued, it became a battle for life. The girls unwittingly pitted against each other for survival as they tried to climb up out of the vault and onto the four-foot deep pool of waste.
Yuck.
Elsie Shore and her playmate, Ida Breach, held onto each other on the way down and helped each other stay above the muck. The weaker ones were crushed down by the stronger and forced under the mass of filth to their death.
Oh my God.
As reported by the Cincinnati Inquirer.
Woof.
Lorena Ferguson was just entering the door, standing on the sill, when the floor dropped right away in front of her eyes. Clara Steinkamp, 8, grabbed her dress from behind and kept her from falling in on one of the girls in front of her. After she took a good look at the terrible scene unfolding below, she made a dash for the school to get help. Principal Zimmerman said that after the students left the building, he walked across the hallway to speak to one of the teachers. and quote, a few minutes later, two of the little girls ran into the room and exclaimed that a girl had fallen into the vault.
A girl?
Right.
This is a whole
lot more
pack.
A whole pack of gals. Yeah. A gaggle of gals. He said, I did not realize the awful calamity that had overcome us, but hurried in the direction of the outbuilding. On the way, I met a number of others. They were screaming wildly at the top of their voices, and it was some time before one of them could compose herself sufficiently to explain what had happened. Another little girl ran to the high school classroom, which was still in session, and alerted Miss Una Venable of the collapse. She and the four high school boys rushed for the outhouse and arrived at the same time as Principal Zimmerman. No warning from the hysterical girl screaming in the rain could have prepared him for what he was about to discover. There was only one narrow door to the outhouse, and the dozen toilet seats were still attached to the three side of the wall, but there was no floor at all. The sight of the girls, some of them scrambling to climb the walls, others struggling to keep their heads above the sickening waist, and nearly all of them screaming, "Help me, save me," called the principal to stagger back and almost faint.
Oh my gosh.
William Schultz, who was 20 at the time, and his friend John Carell, who was 18, had been across the street in the Presbyterian Church's manse with Pastor Ira D. Lambert, the town barber, Gil Wright, and a few others. It sounds like a book. Like,
yeah.
All of these names.
Yeah.
Gil Wright and Ida.
Gil Wright.
They were at the church when they heard the shrill screams of the girls running away from the outhouse in the pouring rain. The men peered through a window but couldn't see anything, but as they looked, they began to hear the fainter screams of the girls trapped in the vault. They could make out pleas of Mama and Papa, and they looked from one to another in the moment, and the horrible reality of what they were hearing began to set in. Without exchanging a word, the men ran out into the rain into the girls' outhouse. Zimmerman was already there in the narrow doorway, half mad with anguish.
Oh my gosh.
And the boys push him aside. The horrified men looked down into the pit, the paper reported, and the surface, dimly seen in the half-gloom caused by the outhouse roof, was but a mass of writhing, childish bodies, which rose and sunk under the filth that filled the pit.
Nightmares.
Take a cleansing breath. Zimmerman quickly rallied himself, called out for a rope and ladders, and Ms. Venable's boys leaped into action. Zimmerman dropped to the ground and leaned as far over as he could over the vault's edge, but he couldn't reach any of the girls. The men held onto his legs and lowered him down further and managed to rescue three girls this way before the ladders and ropes arrived. But the step ladders from the school were too short, and the ropes were clotheslines that proved to be as rotten as the privy joists.
Yikes.
Mr. Zimmerman reached down a rope and told me to grab it, said Hazel. I wrapped it around my head and he drew me up pretty near the top when the rope broke and I fell back again. I sank down and a hand pulled me under. A second rope broke in the same way. Then James Smith, 16, climbed into the belfry and brought a rope off of the bell. It worked a little better and helped save two more girls. While I was waiting for a longer ladder, Zimmerman said, I begged the children to be quiet and brave and I would rescue them. Some of the older girls took his cue and tried to calm the girls, but it was of little use.
Aww.
One of the boys found a longer ladder in a barn about 100 yards away. The principal dipped it into the muck, and it was not long enough to reach all the way from the bottom of the vault to the ledge, but it was close enough for Zimmerman and some of the other men to descend and lift the girls out of the mess, bucket brigade style.
Okay.
As fast as Mr. Zimmerman handed up the children, I took them and passed them along to the others who carried them to the schoolroom, said Mrs. Venable. The girls were unrecognizable, their eyes clenched shut as they sobbed and gasped for breath. The struggle down there was terrible, reported Hazel. As long as I could get out of the water to take a breath of air, I felt sure of being saved, but when I fell back into the hole, I thought it was all over. The girls about me were grabbing onto me, everybody grabbed at each other, and when we did get a hold of the wall, it was only for a second. I caught hold several times, but when I was pulled up by the others, my hand slipped. There were only a few taken out when I felt something underneath my feet. It must have been some little girl that had drowned. All the time I prayed. I said my prayers over and over. I could not see for a while, and I was praying to the Lord to save me. I found the rake in my hands. When I came into the light, I saw Principal Zimmerman. I crawled up and was lifted out. After struggling in the crowd with her friends, 14-year-old Edna Girk again found the jutting stone and gave it another try, this time with two hands. Far above me, she said, it seemed, somebody was coming down a ladder and called to me. Suddenly, someone took a hold of me, and I looked back over my shoulder and saw the agonized faces of my friends.
Aww.
Then I lost consciousness and knew no more until I woke up in the schoolroom surrounded by the bodies of my friends. Girk's arms were severely bruised and punctuated by deep scratches, wounds she attributed to the clawing attempts of her classmates to climb up and over her out of the foul water. The rain abated, but the respite in the weather did little to relieve the pandemonium. Many of the girls fainted soon after emerging from the vault, adding fear that they had succumbed to the terrible fumes, to the overall confusion. Neighbors of the school offered their homes as triage centers. Rescuers carried them out of the rain and into safety while they're revived, cleaned up, and comforted. William Schultz and John Coral, the two young men with Pastor Lambert, volunteered to go down and search for bodies. Somebody gave them each a rake and they climbed down the ladder and waded into the muck. Schultz immediately bumped into the body of Flora Forrest and hoisted her up the ladder into waiting hands. She was unconscious but alive.
Oh, okay. Good.
Schultz and his companions would pull nine more little girls from the privy vault. Dr. Ulysses G. Senor.
These names.
I know. Dr. Ulysses G. Senor, who had come to the scene to check on his daughter, immediately went to work reviving the fainting victims, gave the last nine girls hypodermic injections of nitroglycerin, hoping to give boost to whatever spark of life may have remained. None of the nine survived.
Aww.
The high school classroom became a temporary morgue as volunteers carried the bodies inside away from gawking eyes. Sisters Carmen and Fausta Card, ages 7 and 11, were found clasped tightly in each other's arms and were laid out in the classroom that same way. Fausta's twin, Rotha, was with her sisters when the floor collapsed, but managed to keep her footing and stayed on top of the pile. Emma Steinkamp was one of the last bodies to be removed. By then it was 12:30 and the sun was shining. Hamilton County Coroner Walter B. Weaver arrived in his automobile. The crowd swelled as relatives began streaming in from downtown Cincinnati. It had taken about an hour for newspaper accounts of the collapse to reach the broader community, and word spread quickly, and Pleasant Ridge residents who worked downtown ran for the last two trains that led to the village, where they were met with frantic children and mothers of the victims pacing in front of the school. Steve Carell and Flora Force were removed to Dr. Senor's homes. Stella was vomiting blood, and Dr. Senor was not sure she would live. Rescuers took the other 19 children to neighborhood homes, but no one kept a roster of who had been pulled from the vault and where she went. Frantic confusion continued for several more hours as more and more people arrived from nearby villages, especially Rosmoyne, although most of the girls who crammed into the privy lived in Pleasant Ridge. The routes between the school and the train stations were crammed with people. The village's telephone system was not able to keep up with all of the calls. And there were hundreds of people crowding around this, like, disaster scene. When the adrenaline rush of the rescue abated, Principal Zimmerman and his teacher sobbed along with the parents who lost their daughters. Dr. Senor was exhausted and emotionally distraught.
Ooh, I bet.
And ordered the principal to go across the street to rest in one of the houses. And Dr. Senor remained there the remainder of the afternoon and evening, tending to the family and the kids. When the last body had been removed, the village fire department began pumping the filth out of the vault. After examining the nine little bodies on the classroom floor, Coroner Weaver investigated the outhouse, and it only took a glance. Rotten, rotten, rotten were his first words. Everything was rotten. Those joists would not hold anything. Coroner Weaver issued his verdict on October 19th, citing suffocation as the cause of the nine deaths and declaring gross negligence on the part of the Board of Education. The accident occurred on account of the decayed condition of the joist supporting the floor covering the vault, his report read, and the floor was in such a condition as to indicate that it had been laid when the joists were in this state of decay. So if the guy who installed the flooring the year prior had inspected the joists, this would not have happened.
Oof, what a horrible, like, burden to bear.
Seriously. And no charges were ever filed or indictments were ever issued.
Okay.
The village of Pleasant Ridge relieved their indignation in a democratic fashion. The Board of Education election that November included none of the incumbents, deferring to a pure citizens' ticket of nominees. Board members maintained to the end that in spite of the coroner's ruling, there was nothing they could have done to foresee or prevent the disaster. And the people who were up for re-election said they did not want to seek another term if they had to fight for it. It's also likely they could not muster enough support for such a nomination.
For sure.
This is an article. The source is The Cincinnati Privy Disaster of 1904, published November 4th, 2014, by Richard O. Jones,
from the Belt. Wow. The Belt magazine.
Okay.
And that is the story.
Wow.
Of what may possibly be the most disgusting disaster.
Oh, that's so horrible.
This makes me never want to go into porta potty.
Ever again.
Oh my God. I would. I can't talk about it. I'm going to gag. Hold on. I can't.
Gag.
I can't. Okay. I'm not going to go into detail about that. I will throw up on your floor right now.
Yeah. I had a porta potty at work for a really long time.
Ooh.
Because I was working out of a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And many a time I would come to work and my porta potty would be tipped over. Due to wind or whatever, like, they didn't secure it very well.
Oh.
And for a long time, I was very afraid of being in it.
When it would. Oh my God, please stop. Taylor, no.
Tip over.
No. Oh my God, with you in it?
Yeah. That was a big fear of mine for a long time.
I'm straight going to pass out. Hold on.
I'm so sorry.
Okay.
Oh, yikes.
Okay, go follow us on the social media.
Do you have a bright and shiny?
Oh, yes. Indoor plumbing.
Okay, that's fair. Indoor plumbing. I like it.
It's going to be huge.
It's going to be big.
What's yours?
Let's see. Okay, so there is a YouTube video that is just every Joey Pacey moment from Dawson's Creek from the very beginning until the end.
Who's Joey Pacey?
Joey is the girl from Dawson's Creek and Pacey is the boy.
Oh, okay. Is this the clip that you posted on Snapchat?
No, it's not.
Oh, God. But I can't keep
it
up.
Did make me think of that.
Okay.
And it's like an hour long, but it's just an episode if you just care about Joey and Pacey.
Okay.
And so I watched that the other day because it makes me happy. It
did bring you joy.
It brought me joy. That's my bright and shiny.
That's all that matters.
With like a side of Joshua Jackson.
That's the guy that you posted.
Yes. Okay. Who is also Pacey.
Okay.
He plays Pacey in Dawson's Creek. Oh. But the clip I posted on Instagram was me watching Cursed, and he is the main character in Cursed.
I can't. Oh, so it's JC and Pacey?
Jade. Joey.
Joey. And Pacey is the boy.
Yes. Joey is short for Josephine.
Ah, got it.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't get it. I'm so happy that it brings you joy. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
I tried it.
You did.
I did.
Yeah. Happy for you.
I love you.
I love you too. All right. Go follow us on the social medias. You can leave us a review if you like it.
Send us your spooky stories and bright and shiny.
Yeah. So you can do that to the email at alittlebitgrim@gmail.com, or you can send us a message on our website, which is alittlebitgrim.com.
And be kind to yourself.
And to others. Goodbye.